This message was presented at the 2016 Lightbearers Convocation. The theme presented was Covenant Kingdom. Thank you for listening.
When I was a little boy, I was afraid of the world. I mean, really afraid of the world. Because in my world, there were lots of horrific, ugly things to be afraid of. My earliest memories are of human faces contorted with rage, mouths formed to speak profanities and ugliness to one another. My world was filled with clenched fists that were thrusting outward from human bodies to strike others. I was really afraid of the world as a little boy. But I had heard rumors and I had seen pictures at school of an incredibly beautiful creature. And the rumor was that this creature lived in the ocean. And I could barely wrap my little boy mind around it as I sat there in school looking at the pictures. And one day, I was at the beach. I grew up in Southern California, and the waves were so big. But I just stood there looking out into the ocean, into that vast, watery ocean. And that picture was imprinted on my mind that even though behind me, in the other direction, away from the ocean, back there at home, there was horror and ugliness and pain, but somewhere out there in that ocean, there was something, some beautiful creature, some amazing creature. But I was afraid even of the ocean. The waves were big. I couldn't bring myself to dive in to the waves at that age. I just couldn't do it. I just stood there looking, and I wanted to run. I wanted to hide from everything in my world. And so I did. I ran and I hid with my imagination. I ran and I hid in the wonder of this creature that just captivated me. I was obsessed with this creature. And so I escaped spontaneously, I guess. This is how the human psyche works. I escaped spontaneously, no effort required. I escaped in my dreams. And as a little boy, because I couldn't work up the courage to go be one with that beautiful creature in the ocean, in my imagination, in my dreams, I saw myself standing in front of those waves. And as I was standing there in my dream now, trying to work up the courage to dive in, here came that beautiful creature straight up out of the ocean, circled around behind me, went straight through my legs. I grabbed the dorsal fin, and I found myself on the back of a dolphin. And the dolphin began to swim out into the ocean, diving down deep and then coming up. And in my dream, I would breathe. And down we'd go again. The next thing I know, in my dream, I could feel it. I knew I was smiling. And I think the dolphin was smiling. And then the dream went where dreams often go. It got really weird. And the dolphin that was just going through the ocean, which is weird enough, I admit, came up out of the ocean toward the shore and began flying through city streets. And there I was, a little boy on the back of the dolphin through the city streets, and I'm just waving as I go. Just me and my dolphin. And then we began to go into buildings and up stairways, and there were people doing what people do in buildings. There were receptionists and business people, and I was just smiling, just me and my dolphin. Hey, how's it going? And then back out of the buildings and down the streets and into the ocean again, and the dream was over. And this was, for me, a recurring dream. Over and over again, just a little refuge, a little escape, a little hiding place in my imagination from the horror of life. And then fast forward many, many years. Now I'm married and we have 3 children and we're on a tropical island. And I say to the guy that we know there that we're visiting with, hey, do you have a boat, or you know somebody who has a boat? I understand there are dolphins around this island. He says, dude, people who live here all their lives never see dolphins. Have you seen how big the ocean is? I said, well, do you have a boat or not? Yeah, I have a boat. Can we just go out and look? Okay. So we go out half mile, 3/4 mile from the shore. We're sitting there, me, Sue, Amber, Jason, and Leah. We're just sitting there in the boat. Time is elapsing. It's starting to drizzle. The water's heaving. We're out there for maybe an hour, and he says, we better go back. We're not going to see dolphins. And just then, my daughter Leah says, look! And we all look in the direction that she's indicating, and just ever so briefly, boom, that dark, sharp fin up and gone. And so I got up and I dove in and I began swimming as my wife's screaming, what if it's a shark? And I'm thinking in my mind, it's worth it. And I began swimming for all I'm worth toward that fin that came up out of the water, going under and looking. I come up, it is sharks. Just kidding. And I go down again and I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dolphins right there. They're there. The water's crystal clear. It's so beautiful. I come up. They are dolphins. Plop, plop, plop. They all jump in and begin swimming. Leah's under the water with her underwater camera. Click, 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 click. And I go down again, and there they are, deep down in the crystal clear water. I begin counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I lose count at 60. And then I notice that one of them had a plastic bag over its head. And I thought, litter bugs! I was so upset. And then that dolphin passed the bag to another one, who passed it to another one, who passed it to another one, and they were playing with it. I thought, a little litter's not that bad, I guess. They have to have something to play with. And as my family begins to swim back to the boat, and I just can't bring myself to turn around and go. I'm just swimming and swimming along the shoreline, and they're deep, and then they come up all around me, in front of me, to my right, to my left. They're behind me. I'm swimming for all I'm worth. I look for the boat. It's getting farther away. I just keep swimming. They go down, and they come up again, and down, and they come up again. And then I think, I better go back. So I turn around, I begin to swim in the opposite direction, and I kid you not, all these dolphins swimming in one direction, as I turned around to go the other way, they all circled around, they surrounded me, and they said, in their body language, in their swimming pattern, they said, dude, we're going this way. So I turned around and I just began swimming with them again as long as I could. It was the most incredible, beautiful experience I'd ever had. 2 months later, I'm on the Amazon River. I'm out on the Amazon River in this small little boat with a motorcycle engine and a guy who's taken us out where we've been distributing literature along the Amazon River. And I say to him, the pink dolphins are in this river, right? And he says, big river, few dolphins. Can I see the dolphins? I say to him. I've lived here my whole life. I've never seen the dolphins. Now you're going to think, Ty, that didn't happen. I'm telling you, I believe in the investigative judgment, and this happened. I'm not lying to you. The fact is, I had two friends with me and this guide, and when he says, I've never seen them and I've lived here my whole life, a few minutes pass by and the pink dolphins begin jumping out of the water all around. I stand up spontaneous and he says, piranhas. So I didn't jump in. Now the Bible paints a picture of reality that is so irresistibly beautiful that if you can bring yourself to believe it, you will never be the same again. Now, it's going to take us a few minutes to build this picture, but I want to ask you to come on a journey with me. And in this journey, in Revelation 21 and 22, we read some of the most magnificent words that have ever been written. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. Now if you're like this little boy, that means all the pain, all the suffering, all the horror, all the clenched fists, all the contorted lips formed to say mean things. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and also there was no more sea. I don't know what that's about. We'll go on. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Now again, God is using language in order to create images in our imaginations. He wants us to not only see something, he wants us to feel something. God wants us, by his use of language, to wrap our minds and hearts around his vision of ultimate reality. He wants us to see it as it is. And he wants us to know that at the heart of reality, there's matrimony. At the heart of reality, there is intimate love. In God's ultimate purpose for you and for me, we collectively, corporately, we are bride. We are female corporately. He is male, and he's in love with us. And he is leading us incrementally, step by step, to compose that bride in a city called New Jerusalem, so that we would have the privilege of engaging in a kind of endless, eternal falling in love with him, a nonstop free fall in love. The fact is, and you know it if you stop and think about it, that love is the only exponential reality in existence. Love is the only thing that has no edges, no top, no bottom, no ceiling, no floor. You all know, if you stop and think about it, that it's always possible to love somebody more than you ever have before. Even if you've loved them for years and years and years, it's possible to be in a conversation with somebody you've been married to for years, or a child that you've raised up into adulthood, or a friend that you've known since high school. It's possible to engage in a conversation with a fellow human being and for them to say something that gives a perspective on their personality or their character, their opinions, their views, that causes you to know them in ways you've never known them before, and therefore to love them and like them in ways you've never loved or liked them before. In a deeper way, a more intelligent love, a more passionate love. Wow, you're more incredible than I thought. You're amazing. I've always loved you, and now suddenly I love you more than I ever have before. Love is exponential by its very nature. The thing itself has the potential for eternal growth and development. You and I will spend all of eternity in a kind of matrimonial tryst with God. We will forever and ever and ever find ourselves falling more and more deeply in love with the Creator of the universe. There is matrimony at the heart of reality as God sees it. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is, note the word, with men. And he will dwell, note the word again, with them. And they shall be his people. And God himself will, what's the word again? Be with them and be their God. There is in God's heart for you and me, there is this with idea. Call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted as God with us. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. God, John, with God, apparently. And down to verses 18 and 19 of John 1, Jesus then says, if you're wondering where I came from into the world, I came from the bosom of the Father. I came from deep intimacy and friendship with the Father. That's where I've been for all eternity past. I've been with the Father. Not just in geographic proximity, not that kind of with. Is anybody here in love? Does anybody here have a grandson, a granddaughter? Does anybody have a best friend? Has anybody been married approximately forever? You know what it's like, don't you? To be with someone and not physically in their presence. It's not the physical proximity that Jesus is talking about or that John is talking about. The fact is that there is a withness in God's system that equates to friendship. You and I were crafted, engineered, made from the inside out for friendship, for relationships, for covenant. We were made for covenant kingdom. We were made to live together with grandmas and grandpas and nanas and papas and moms and dads and brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles and nephews and nieces, where we all love one another with expanding circles of social interaction. God's ultimate goal for you and me is that we would be with him, that we would be with him. Verse 4, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Well, this is chapter 21. Before that is chapter 20, the millennium. Apparently, as we come out of the millennium and New Jerusalem lands, there's going to be a whole lot of crying. There are going to be tears. And God is the kind of God, if you can just imagine this, the creator of the universe is the kind of person that sees tears and has the impulse to reach out his hand and brush them from cheeks. Now, that God, who with that kind of heart, who sees tears and wants to dry them and wipe them away, is an extraordinarily beautiful God. God is not only powerful, God is not only wise, God is the epicenter of all pure emotion and passion, and he will wipe tears from your eyes and mine. And we will never cry again, except maybe tears of happiness or joy. But the tears of pain, they'll all be wiped away. The fact is that you and I are headed for a place where God will not only wipe away all tears from our eyes, but if we can wrap our minds around this, God is leading us to a place where we undergo such dramatic, deep, and lasting emotional healing that we lose all emotional memory of evil and sin. There is some current science that I don't have time to go into that demonstrates that it's possible for human beings to have the emotional memories of a trauma erased while retaining the factual memory of the thing that happened. I, for example, was raised in a home with a lot of trauma. But if I were to tell you my story right now, I can tell you it would be, in a very real sense, like telling you somebody else's story. Because I don't relate to it, I know it happened, the facts of the case are in my factual memory. But my emotional memory is completely free of those experiences through a process of relationship with a girl named Sue and a God named Jesus. And through that process, I would be like, yeah, this happened, you know, but it's kind of weird that I know it was me, but not. God will wipe away all tears. No more death, no sorrow, no crying. Come on, this is amazing. Has anybody put pen to paper and written anything this incredible? No more crying? There shall be no more pain? None? No, none. No pain. For the former things have passed away. It's all gone. And as the millions and billions and trillions of years go by, Ellen White says we will have a life that measures with the life of God. Just on and on and on and on. Can you imagine? And as the millions of years go by, finally at some point for you, at some point for me, I don't know at what point, because we all have different levels of woundedness and traumas, but at some point in the process, somebody has said that we will look back and that the worst traumas in this life will look to us from that vantage point like one night in a bad hotel. That's how deep the healing's going to be. And it can begin now. If it hasn't begun now for you, then by all means, you need to meet Jesus and look deep into his heart, and you will begin to experience the healing power of his grace. And you will sense it so deeply that you will begin to have a vision of what you look like as the you that you are, with all the pain and the woundedness and the suffering and the damage completely deleted from your entire mental and emotional hard drive. Just imagine you 2.0. Imagine you with all the bad stuff removed and all the good things about you maximized and flowering for all eternity with maturity. Imagine that you. Because that's the you that you are from God's perspective. This is amazing. Then he who sat on the throne. This is God the Father. And he just chimes in. I got something to say here. John's writing. And hey, John, behold, I make all things new. And John just writes it. Quote, unquote, John heard the Father, the creator of the universe. And he wrote it so we could read it. Now, the New Jerusalem is mentioned here, and Jerusalem in Revelation 21 and 22, Jerusalem, my friends, is a concept, it's an idea, it's a matrix of human existence that John is lifting from the Old Testament. He's reaching back into what God has been revealing to prophets down through the ages, and he's importing Jerusalem into his visions here. Now, Jerusalem comes from a lot of Old Testament texts, but just let yourself be blown away by this. Isaiah is the primary source of John giving us his revelation in chapters 21 and 22. Now, it shall come to pass, Isaiah says, in the latter days, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. Now check this out. And all nations shall flow to it, to the Lord's house. And then he goes on. Many people, he says, shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. Why do they want to go? He will teach us of his ways. The word ways here means he will teach us of his patterns, the way he does things, the way God navigates reality, his ways. And we shall walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth, what? The law. Hold on to that. We're coming back to the law. Out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from where? From Jerusalem. And watch this, verse 4. Don't let this be lost upon you. And he shall judge between the nations and rebuke many peoples. That's sounding kind of harsh, but look where it's going. They shall beat their swords, implements of violence, into plowshares, implements of agriculture, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. And I love this. This is one of the best lines in Scripture and all of literature. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Now, what's being described here? You can't imagine, you could not yourself construct a more beautiful ultimate picture of reality. Basically, what he's describing here is human beings living together in benevolent, nonviolent, agrarian social structures. Basically, it's a hippie commune without marijuana. Basically, what he's describing is you and me, all of us in a community living together, and there is no war, and there aren't even any implements of war. There are no weapons manufacturers, people. Everything's about cultivating the earth to maximum yield, and you're sharing your flowers with me, and I'm sharing my broccoli with you, and that's what he's describing. And this is the idea of Jerusalem. Jeru, city, Salem, shalom, the city of peace. Shalom, however, is a word that we often translate as peace, and the word has been somewhat emasculated of its true Hebrew meaning. The biblical meaning of the idea of shalom is not the idea of personal tranquility. Me alone in a room, in a chair, meditating myself into a state of mind. Shalom, peace from a biblical perspective, is not an individual achieving a state of mind. It's not the idea of personal tranquility, it's rather the idea of relational harmony. Check this out. The plan of salvation is not merely about saving me, the individual. It's about saving us, the community. Salvation is a communal venture. You cannot go home, shut your doors because you're bummed out about what's going on in the world and in church, and think you're going to be, quote unquote, saved by being all alone watching 3ABN. You need to get up out of your chair and you need to go socialize with human beings. You and I, we flower, if we're going to flower at all, in relationships. And in isolation, we gradually die. The plan of salvation, it's about saving our relationships with one another. There is no salvation in isolation. God isn't in the business of saving merely me, the individual. God's in the business of saving Susan, you and me, together, looking into one another's eyes and being friends for eternity without harm. God is saving the community. And then in Isaiah chapter 11, this is for me one of the most incredible things that you'll ever read. I just love it. I can't get enough of it. The wolf, that's a predatory creature. That's the only way we know the wolf, as a predatory creature. The wolf also shall lie down with the lamb. That's a docile creature. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling, what's that word? Together. There's the with idea again. And check this out. And a little child shall lead them. Just imagine this picture. Leopard, lion, bear, wolf, lamb, and a child right in the middle of the whole situation. And nobody's freaking out. Nobody's worried. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt, nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. What a picture! Humans and animals coexisting without harm to either. This is John's source material. John is Isaiah literate, and he's bringing that in to his picture of the new heavens and the new earth. Shalom is a condition of life in which everything intersects with everything else without causing harm. That's the biblical idea of shalom. It is a tapestry of interwoven relationships. You with me with you, us with everybody else, and all of us as human beings in relationship with the animal creation and in relationship with the earth and the entire ecosystem, and there is no harm. Relationships that are beautiful, all parts of creation flourishing, free from all forms of selfishness, magnificently alive with outgoing love. Can you imagine? Can you remember the very highest point in your experience where you as a human being truly, genuinely were alive with love for another human being? I remember when each of my children were placed in my arms at birth. So exciting, so deep, so beautiful, so free in that moment. Everything in my heart longing only for their good. Imagine the point in your life where you have loved the most intensely, the most purely. And then that moment, imagine being every moment of every day, but way beyond that. Just imagine what it's going to be. Shalom is complete relational integrity. That's what it is. It's about relationships with one another, with the animal kingdom, and with the earth itself. And Isaiah drew his vision. Now, John drew his material from Isaiah largely, but Isaiah drew his material, his vision of God's plan for relational systems from Moses. Moses is incredible. Moses stands alone, head and shoulders above Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and every other philosopher and legislator of history. Moses is without peer in all of history because God communicated into that brother's frontal lobe a picture of what the world could be like. In a world, this is Moses' world, in a world of intellectual ignorance and moral degradation and generational abuse, you can read all of this in the Old Testament, everything from child sacrifice to all kinds of horrible religious rituals that were based on fear, and the people were enslaved to their religious ideas, hierarchical dictatorships. It's all the world knew until Moses came along. And theological darkness. In that world, God, through Moses, selected a group of people, a controlled study, if you will. God selected a group of people, charted a new path, established a system of progressive laws. I'll say more about that in a moment. All grounded in the principle of love, and I'm about to prove that to you, to facilitate relational integrity on all levels. This is Moses. Now, some of you are thinking at this point, that's in the Old Testament? Yeah. The Old Testament is astounding. Those who haven't read it thoroughly see monsters, and they assume that God is the monster. But the fact is, check this out. This is all from the Old Testament. God gave to Moses the constitutional blueprints for his, that is God's social system. And it was called the law. In the New Testament, it's just called the law. And that means the whole body of the writings of Moses, the law, when you read about it in the New Testament, in most instances. It was called the law. Sometimes it's called the law of Moses. In scholarly circles, the Mosaic law. Now check this out. What was this law about? This is all Old Testament. First of all, land ownership. Moses taught that it was the privilege and right of every human being to own land without taxation. I'm not going to get into the details there right now. But Moses taught that it was a privilege and right of every human being to have his own plot of land. When the minor prophets envision God's ultimate purpose for the world, what it looks like for human beings to be in a state of shalom, it poetically says, every man under his fig tree and his vine. You can't imagine anything more beautiful than owning a piece of property. Sue and I have done it. We owned a 20-acre piece of property. We planted all kinds of incredible things. It all grew. We built a house on it. No happier time in my life. If everyone has a piece of ground, everything's going to be better for the world at large. So there was the privilege. This is Moses. Moses taught the people that everyone should own land. And there was a liberty system called the Jubilee. It was like a reset button. And what the reset button of the Jubilee meant is that the land shall not be sold in perpetuity. Do you know what that means? That means that under Moses, if you got yourself in a financial pickle and you had to sell your land that in Moses' thinking you had the right to own, if you sold your land, you couldn't sell it forever. At the end of Jubilee, the person you sold it to has to give it back. So it's a reset button where every human being always, ultimately, has the maximum potential for flourishing. Because you have land. You always have land. The Jubilee was a grace system that ensured that a person's failures would not irreversibly impoverish the family. This is Old Testament. This is Old Testament. So there was land ownership laws under Moses. And then there were agricultural laws. And I'm just giving you a few of them here. The land must rest every seventh year. If you planted fruit trees, you could not harvest the fruit, depending on the trees, until 3, 4, or 5 years had passed by. The 3, 4, 5 law for fruit trees, Sue and I followed this rule. And you get maximum quality of produce if you patiently wait for the land to do what the land does. There were pruning laws, literally. You could not, under Moses, own a piece of land, have fruit trees, and not take care of your trees properly. Somebody might come and say, looks like your trees need to be pruned, bro. Okay, I'll get to that. You couldn't ruin your land. It had to flourish under your stewardship. Isn't this incredible? And this was all for soil replenishment and maximum yields. So there were agricultural laws. There were animal laws under Moses. An animal, according to the law of Moses, must be relieved of a burden even if the owner was your enemy. You had to have compassion on any animal you encountered. You could not see an animal suffer under Mosaic law and not intervene. You cannot muzzle an animal while it's working. This is so benevolent. You're working the animal is allowed to eat. Don't you dare, for financial greediness, muzzle that animal. He's free to eat. Must be given, the animal, even your animals must be given rest on the Sabbath. I love that. Love it, love it, love it. And check this out. Just think of the tenderness of the heart of God coming through Moses and saying, hey, Moses. Also, if people are out walking and they come across a mother bird and her eggs, and they need to eat because they just need to eat, you can't traumatize the bird. You got to send the mother away before you take the eggs. But don't take the eggs in the presence of the mother. Be compassionate. This is Moses, people. And this is the heart of God through Moses. And the animal laws created such a sensitivity in the hearts of the Jews that Josephus, in the first century, Jewish historian, recounts how Herod also got together a great quantity of wild beasts and of lions and in great abundance and of such other beasts as were either uncommon strength or of such a sort as were rarely seen. So he's getting together all these ferocious animals, Herod is. These were trained either to fight with one another, or men who were condemned to death were to fight with the animals. I don't know what you think about that or how you feel about that, but check this out. And truly, foreigners, Josephus says, were greatly surprised and delighted at the vast expenses of the shows and at the great danger of the spectacles. They called it entertainment. But to the Jews, it was a palpable, that is, a deeply felt breaking up of those customs for which they had so great veneration. Century after century after century, God, through the law of Moses, sensitized their hearts to the animal kingdom. Oh, I wish we had time to go into this, but let me just nudge your brain in a direction. The reason animals are afraid naturally and flee from us as human beings is because we have violated them so egregiously over and over again that we, fallen stewards, have instilled fear in animals so they want nothing to do with us anymore unless we domesticate them, and even those animals aren't sure about us. Health laws under the law of Moses, bodily discharges required washing. This is in a world where there is so much filth without the scientific understanding of how disease is transferred. Nobody's washing their hands. Nobody's taking baths unless you're a Jew. And now suddenly things have to be clean all the time. You have to bury your excrement. Every Jew had a shovel. And when you had to relieve yourself, you didn't just do it like they did it for centuries in London, where they said of London, you could smell it before you could see it. The Mosaic system was more sophisticated than many cities in the world today. You had to go out of the camp to do your business. You could not eat scavenger animals. And if there was recurring mold, you had to burn down the building so you wouldn't get sick. This is all mercy. This is all compassion. This is all very high-level science without God explaining the science. Just saying, hey, I don't have time to explain the science, and you're all kind of dense anyway, so just don't eat all that trash. And if there's mold all around you, I can't explain it to you right now, but just burn that stuff and build a new dwelling. There were educational laws. The daily temple rituals were an educational system that unfolded by means of enactment. The people were required to engage their intellects, to learn, to process. You shall, the Bible says in Deuteronomy, you shall teach your children. Literacy was a requirement. The children had to be taught. Check this out. Laws for the poor. Justice for the poor in a dispute. You could not, under Mosaic law, favor somebody who had wealth over somebody who was poor. You simply had to judge a case without partiality. You're not to afflict an orphan or a widow. Anybody who's down and out, anybody who's disadvantaged, anybody who is on the margins, anybody who's wounded, you have to take special care for those people to provide for them under Mosaic law. You are not to reap your entire field. Why? Because you're to leave food for the poor so they can come. Hey, come on. You can. It's all here for you. Just take whatever you need. Just take whatever you need. You must not, under Mosaic law, harden your heart or shut your hand to the poor. Is anybody blown away by this? This is the Mosaic system. There were labor and business laws. Workers were allowed to eat as they worked. And then there was the win-win rule for buying and selling. Check this out. Under Mosaic law, you could never sell something for more than it was worth if you knew the condition of the thing. You could not conceal the truth of the matter. You had to, every financial transaction had to be beneficial to both parties, or you're not allowed to make the transaction. That's Mosaic law, people. You're not to loan with interest to a brother. Predatory lending, which nearly brought the entire world economic system down in 2008, predatory lending was against the law under Moses. And some of us were thinking that Moses was kind of a barbaric, outdated. This is the most sophisticated system, social and economic system, the world has ever seen. I'll say more about that in a moment. Labor and business laws continue. You are not, check this out, just feel the mercy of this. You are not to require payment of a debt from a man you know cannot pay you. If you are in a position, you're financially, you're fine. And a loan was made. Well, first of all, you're not allowed to charge interest to that brother. You're helping him. It's a benevolent action. It's a generosity. You're loaning. You're helping him get back on his feet. And then if his situation doesn't change, if it gets worse, if you assess, he can't pay me back. Under Mosaic law, you don't have to pay that. Don't have to pay it back. You are not allowed to exact a debt by force. No fraud in measuring or selling was allowed. And every 7 years, no matter what anybody owed anybody, clean slate, equalizing the whole system and giving everybody every 7 years vantage ground. Dignity maintained. And everybody now can look at one another in the eye and start fresh and begin business dealings again. This is astounding. And this came from the heart of God through Moses to a band of slaves wandering through the wilderness. The tithe was a flat tax system, which I favor, by the way, but I'm not going into my politics here. There was, in the tithe system, an acknowledgement of God as the source, and it centered a person's dependence in God's character rather than on any unjust human system. This is amazing. The Sabbath was and had economic implications. There was in the Sabbath law in Exodus 20 an anti-slavery provision. You've read it. There was in the Sabbath direct accountability for each individual to God. This is amazing. The Sabbath is a law of human dignity. Those who have control of the financial system, I may be under them, but come every seventh day, we're all equal. And you can't require me to continue producing income for you. We're going to all rest eye to eye. And it also produced rejuvenation, physical, mental, emotional rejuvenation. Why? To create maximized productivity by means of a rest-work rhythm. So the Sabbath had economic implications, but this is going to blow your mind. Under Mosaic law, there was a naturalization law, a citizenry law. Israel was not and never intended to be a pure bloodline. Under Mosaic law, they had an open immigration policy, but it wasn't a loose immigration policy. They were immigration policies that were stipulated on receiving and vowing to Mosaic law. The way, if there's anybody here who's been naturalized as a citizen of the United States, when it finally came to the point where you could get your citizenship, you went down to a courthouse, you raised your right hand, you said, basically in so many words, I like the Constitution of the United States, I think it's really cool, and I vow to live by the Constitution of the United States. If you say, you know, I don't feel that Constitution thing, you're going back where you came from. You can't be a citizen of this country unless you vow allegiance to the Constitution of the United States of America. Similarly, under Mosaic law, check this out. Anybody could become an Israelite. Anybody could say, that system, I like your system, can I join? And they couldn't say, well, no, you're not of our national descent. You're not of our bloodline. It had nothing to do with that. People distorted it to mean that. And Jesus came and upset that whole system and brought it back where it was supposed to be, which we'll see in just a moment. I'm just in a moment. I mean, who knows if I'll ever say all of this tonight. Allowing Israel to absorb and assimilate, check this out, allowing Israel to absorb and assimilate all the nations of the world. That was God's plan. The whole world was supposed to be Israel. God called a people out not to make them an elite ethnic group. He called them out to send them in. He called them out as a controlled study group to produce flourishing in a community to get the attention of the world so the world would say, whoa, what's going on? Everything's better in that system. Let's join that system. Deuteronomy 4, check this out. Moses explained this logic. See, Moses says to the people, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that, watch this, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them, these laws, carefully, for this will show. Did you ever catch this part? This will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Why are all of their peaches bigger than ours? Why is it that their financial system is so effective? How come in their system they don't have the diseases that we have? Why are they so healthy, wealthy, and wise? Let's join them. The people would realize that, wow, something's going on over here. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way the Lord our God is near us whenever we pray to him? Moses is telling the people this. We got something going on here, Moses is saying. God, our God listens to us. He comes to us. He's teaching us. He's elevating us on all levels, this God. And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? You hear what Moses is telling these people? He's saying this system of law is intrinsic to the operations of reality, the way God designed reality to operate, and if you harmonize with the system of other-centeredness, it will produce. You will flourish on all levels. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you. These weren't arbitrary laws. That it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days, long life, in the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. There were moral laws under Moses, and these are the ones we're most familiar with. There were the Ten Commandments. There was the love your neighbor as yourself law. Treat people exactly the way you want to be treated. That is so, so beyond anything that was happening in the world on a legislative level. Love God supremely and your neighbor as yourself is the way Jesus summarized Mosaic law. Now check this out. Paul in Romans 13:10 essentially says that the essence of the law, he says that love does no harm to its neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. What is the essence of the law? No harm. No harm comes to anybody. And all of this equated to self-governance. In other words, this is astounding. The people of Israel were to have no king. Moses brought them out from bondage to the Pharaoh, to monarchy. And when they expected Moses to dominate them, Moses deferred and said, I'm a prophet, which means I'm an educator. God is doing you the favor of giving you the dignity of knowledge, of information, of wisdom, so that you can have a direct connection with God the same as I do. Moses wasn't the only one who was supposed to be able to go into the mountain into intimate contact with God. All of God's people were supposed to be able to have that intimate contact with God, but they were of a slave mentality because they had been in slavery, so they wouldn't get close to God, but rather preferred slavery to a God who wanted to give them liberty. It's astounding what's happening in this history. There was to be no king. The people were to be governed by prophets, which is to say they were to be governed by knowledge. There were to be no arbitrary or inflatable taxation systems. And there was to be no military under Mosaic law. You're saying, well, wait a minute. Didn't they fight? Yes, they fought. They fought. And God accommodated their fallenness, but he pointed somewhere. Check this out. When we come to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and the Lord God said to Samuel, heed the voice of this people. Do what they're telling you. What's the history here? The people are saying, we want a king. This is later on in the history. Moses is long gone, and they're saying, we want a king. A prophet's not good enough for us. We don't want to exist directly under God educating us. We want a king, and God finally told them, okay, I don't want you to have a king. I don't want monarchy for you. I want a people who are all equal and liberated before me, but if you want a king, they're rejecting me, Samuel. They're not rejecting you. Give them the king that they want, and then God delineated what would happen with the king. It's very interesting. He said, okay, I'm telling you, you don't want a king, but you're insisting, so you're going to have a king. And when you get a king, he will build up a military and take your sons off to war. He will tax your land heavily, and he will take your daughters as concubines. You still want a king? They said, yep, we still want a king. It was not God's system. So then they get Saul, then they get David, and this is amazing. When David comes to the end of his military career, watch this, do not miss this point. When David comes to the end of his military career, he says, okay, I'm done with all the fighting and the war, which the biblical account says that God was with him and giving him victory. Now watch this. And then he comes to the end of his military career and he says, God, the last thing I want to do is I want to build you a temple. And God says, David, you can't build a temple for me, because you have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, for my character. Because in fact, while God is accommodating the situation with his people in their warrior ways, rather than abandon them to destruction, God at his core is decidedly anti-war. So when it comes to building God's temple, God goes on to explain to him, David, you can't build my temple. You're a man of war, and I'm not a God of war. And the fact is, it's going to have to be a person of peace. You're going to have a son. His name is going to be Solomon, which is the male version of Shalom. And Shalom, or peace, will build my temple for me. It'll have to be a man of peace, and that temple will last forever and ever. God is disassociating himself from war. The only reason we don't live under the rule of arbitrary dictators in the world today is because Moses spoke. Moses spoke and initiated for the world systems of law that we in this great republic have been benefiting from without giving Moses due credit. The U.S. right now is headed in a different direction, though. The United States of America is the largest arms dealer, controlling approximately 31% of the world's weapons. The U.S. supplies 94 other nations with their military weapons. In 2015, the U.S. sold more than $46 billion worth of weapons to foreign markets. Most nations in the world have military bases in their own countries. There are a few, who have military bases in other countries. Great Britain has 16 military bases outside of Great Britain. France has 15 military bases outside of France. Russia has 9 military bases outside of Russia. The United States have over 600 military bases around the world. The United States of America is the largest, most powerful, most wealthy financial war machine in the history of mankind. And we, as American citizens, while we have our fondest hopes lodged in the ideals of the Constitution and the freedom that it provides, the military-industrial complex of American imperialism is not the last best hope of this world. Jesus is. With an entirely different system, and that's why Jesus said, if my followers were of this world, they would fight. The implication being, my followers don't fight, because we have a mandate to spread good news of a different kind, a different system. Moses instituted the most sophisticated and sustainable economic system in history, completely based on the principle of other-centeredness. He said to the people after giving this body of laws, oh, that they had a heart in them that they would fear me, God is speaking through Moses, and always keep my commandments, that it might go well with them and their children. What is God's plan here? That it might go well with them. Ellen White comments on the liberty and the mercy that is inherent in the law with these astounding words. The law of Ten Commandments is not to be looked upon as much from the prohibitory side as from the mercy side. Its prohibitions are the sure guarantee of happiness in obedience. As received in Christ, it works in us the purity of character that will bring joy to us through eternal ages. Love requires freedom in order to exist. Here's the bottom line. Love requires freedom in order to exist. And freedom requires love in order to keep existing. We're living in a world that is disintegrating right before our very eyes. And this world is disintegrating because it is being drained of the principle of love for neighbor above self. We live in that kind of world. And God has called you and me to something incredibly, incredibly better. When I was a little boy, I was afraid of the world because there were a lot of things to be afraid of. I want to tell you that by the grace of God, I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid anymore because in Jesus, I have seen a kind of love, a kind of beauty that is so irresistible that it has drawn me in. And I know that when I found myself in that ocean with those beautiful creatures coming up all around me and communicating to me in that moment of some kind of symbiotic relationship with creatures that ought to be afraid and I ought to be afraid, and there was just no fear. And as we moved along the shoreline and we were just swimming along, something inside of me said, this is the way it's supposed to be on all levels, for all creatures, for every man, for every woman, for every child. What a blessing it's been to be here with you over the last few days. We know you prayed throughout the event and maybe before you came that God would do something significant in your heart and in the hearts of the others who are here. It's our sincere hope that you have been richly blessed by considering these themes with us. The prophecies of Daniel and Revelation only make sense in the light of God's love. And when you put Jesus center stage, wow, everything starts to make sense in beautiful new ways. We just want to encourage you, to urge you to take this experience, to open your Bible, to open your heart, to reach out to Jesus in new ways, to say yes to God in new ways. The truths that we've been discovering testify of the existence of a great and beautiful God who only has our best interests at heart. Allow that vision to take center stage in your heart. We love you, and we're really glad that you've shared this time with us.
The mission and passion of Lightbearers is publishing, training, and evangelism. To learn how you can partner with us or hear other messages like this, visit us online at lightbearers.org. You can also call us at 1-877-585-1111 or write to us at Lightbearers 37457 Jasper Lowell Road, Jasper, Oregon 97438. It's through your prayers and generosity that we are able to do what we do. Thank you for listening.